Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is the double Olivier-winning, Tony-nominated director behind such shows as Dear England, Enron, Inc., King Charles III, Tammy Faye, Patriots, and Cold War. His screen career includes directing Ben Whishaw in the BBC adaptation of Richard II, James Franco and Jonah Hill in the movie True Story, and perhaps most notably, directing Renee Zellweger's Oscar-winning performance as Judy Garland in 2019's Judy. He is the artistic director of one of my favourite theatres, the Almeida, having previously run Headlong Theatre Company and since 2010 has been an associate director at the Royal Shakespeare Company. In 2017, he was awarded a CBE for his services to drama. This summer, we met in the boardroom of the Almeida to talk about directing film versus theatre, when to give an actor a note, his early inspirations, what he looks for in emerging talent, how to cast Hamlet, and so much more. This interview was over a year in the making, and having admired Rupert's work for so long, I was honestly quite nervous to record, but I'm so proud of how it turned out. So, please welcome my guest for this episode, Rupert Gould. Rupert, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Not at all.
A few episodes ago, I interviewed Adam James, who you've worked with on a few productions, including King Charles III, and I asked what you like as a director, and he was hugely complimentary, of course, that you're visceral, you've got a quick mind, full of ideas and introspection and thoughts, and that your rehearsal room is never precious and always creative. But the image that stuck with me was when he said, "What I uniquely enjoy about Rupert is that if you could peel back the skin on his forehead, I'd feel like there'd be 42 television screens all playing at the same time." Does this ring true?
It depends what's on the telly. What do you think he meant by that?
I assume he meant that you've got a lot of ideas happening simultaneously, or seeing things from a lot of different angles at once.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, sometimes when I'm bored in tech with my creative team, I play this game called Directing Top Trumps, and we talk about like what would be the sort of, if you were to do top trumps for like directors, or you could do it for actors as well, it's like, what would be the categories?
Yeah.
And so I think with directing, you know, that you might have collaboration, for example, how well do you work with your colleagues and get the best out of them? And you might have dramaturgy or visual ability or, ideas or integrity, who knows? I suppose I have always felt if somebody is stumped about something, particularly an actor, but it could be a designer or whatever, I've always felt that ideas are not always good ideas, but I always have the ideas. I've never felt like that, the fear of the blank page. So maybe he's right in that sense. He might also just mean that when you're an artistic director, of course, you are juggling, you know, a lot of different things. And, you know, when I started the Almeida, for example, both my children were quite young as well. So the rehearsal room, I guess when I started out in my mid-20s, sort of the rehearsal room would be like, you know, yes, it would be where you did the work, but then you might go to the pub afterwards and carry on talking about the work and, you know, be, you know, texting the creative team or the actors later on in the evening, and then you might come in early and you basically lived it. Whereas when you're artistic director, every tea break, every moment you stop, you know, you are having to discuss with the development team or the marketing team or about other productions. And so I hope maybe what Adam is perhaps picking up on is that you're sort of multitasking all the time, and you've always got a lot of different things you're holding together, and some people find that demanding, and I think in general it's quite hard to be the best director you can be and an artistic director at the same time, but it's sort of the bed I made, so that's what
sure. At school, you read Jonathan Miller's subsequent performances.
Mm-hmm.
How did that influence how you view the role of a director?
I think Jonathan had this sort of extraordinary exuberance as a person, and a kind of he always, in a slightly maybe even narcissistic sense, despite his curiosity, sort of centered himself in all his various practices, and I was quite a shy well, he's a very shy child, but then quite a shy teenager as well. And so it's a, sort of theatre in general, I think one of the reasons I was drawn to it was, you know, I knew it wasn't where I was naturally comfortable. I wasn't a show-off, or quite the opposite. Mm. But it was a way of sort of hiding, either when you're acting with someone else's words, or quite simply just being around the extroverts, and I was an introvert. And but I know that in me there was a sort of odd, you know, it's a deep introversion, and I don't think I'm shy particularly anymore, but some legacy of that is there. With, you know, if you look at particularly my stage work, some of it has been, maybe less so now, but certainly when I was a bit younger, sort of characterised by a certain, I don't know, showiness, or some people would critically say sort of attention-seeking in some way. And a subsequent performance had this amazing articulation of the role of the artist, the director as artist, to come in and take the, you know, whether it's the play or whatever the source material might be, as a sort of design drawing to then build on. And it was everything against, I guess, that sort of more Royal Court or even Peter Hall tradition of, you know, the sensitive, subtle reader will interpret and hear the music or the ideas of the text through diligence and sort of supplication towards the genius of the writer. Mm. And I guess I was drawn to Jonathan's version, which was, no, you're an artist in your own right. You know, use it as a sort of jumping off point for the work you want to make. I mean, ironically, as I've got older, but actually it's also because the sector's changed so much and moved towards a sort of massive celebration of that way of making work in directing. Maybe I've kind of drifted back to the more... I mean, I've only directed one revival, I think, in 14 years now, so I've moved back towards new writing in a way, or the text. But yeah, that was that. I mean, I went back to the book, and you know, it's, I don't know quite why it impacted me so much. It's got amazing pictures in it. It was as much about that, the sheer sort of visual gorgeousness of the book. I'm not sure it totally stands up as a sort of, but I tell you what it also was, is there was, The Empty Space was sort of the canonical, the Peterborough text was the canonical text. And I found a lot of directors of my generation when we were starting out were very influenced by Brooke. And I tended to find that work quite boring. I thought it was sort of, a lot of people were doing like a rain stick and a rock and two actors. And I go, that's not theatre. That's sort of some sanctimonious kind of faux ecclesiasticism. You know, I think Brooke is much, much more complicated and interesting than that. But I found Miller as the opposite to Brooke, a kind of... I remember when I did The Tempest at the RSC and John Barton, the late John Barton, I went to see him beforehand. It was the first Shakespeare I'd done at the RSC. And, you know, I thought, I'll go and learn from the great man.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, it's a terrible play, The Tempest. And I said, oh, well, it's my main house debut, so I hope that's not true. And he said, no, it's a rubbish play. He said, there are two ways of doing it. You either do it like Peter does it, which is, you know, with nothing, and it's sort of quite poetic but really boring. Mm. Or you do it like Trevor did it, which is like a full-on circus show, which is lots of fun but rather meaningless. Yes. And I remember thinking, I kind of understand what he means, but I think I'd rather see the circus than the nothing.
I would agree with you. On the subject of new work, back in 2012, when you were putting together the first run of The Effect, mm-hmm. You sent an email to Lucy Prebble, which included a phrase which stuck out to me, which was, when sort of dramaturging the piece, what's tricky is the age-old problem of the man who sneezes in Act 1 always dead by Act 4. How do we give Dr. James a neurological runny nose without signalling too heavily? And it prompted me to wonder how much of great directing is actually about obscuring the plot as well as defining it.
It can be, yeah. I mean, whether, you know, the choices that came out of that note were writing choices or some production as well, but so I wouldn't want to take too much credit for that. But I think, you know, reductively, most plays are kind of constantly oscillating between normally two positions, but it can be more. And those oscillations also can be essentialized in various characters. And so Dr. James in The Effect, you know, is both the sort of maternal, therapeutic figure, and yet also carries a lot of the trauma and the damage of mental health. in her as well, and should she self-cure, love herself more, or recognise that medication or external help, maybe what she needs, is contained within her. She's a great character in a great play where the character essentializes some of those questions. All those four characters do. And I think the director's job is to keep the audience oscillating themselves. And I mean, that's the writer's job as well, but the director is there to work with the writer to maintain that sort of tightrope walk. Because I think the problem with theatre so often, and drama full stop, is you get ahead. You sort of go, I see what's being said here, and then you know how it's going to play out. And we've all done that, sat in the theatre and thought, I know what's coming now. And then that little example is specific, but great plays constantly keep the possibility of surprise there for you, and I think the director is there to serve that.
Yeah. Returning to what you were saying about the different versions of Shakespeare, you've said before that you couldn't essentially sum up successful Shakespearean productions with a single word explaining their concept. So growing up, you saw a 50s Merry Wives of Windsor, Crutches, Richard II, Peter Brook's Circus, Midsummer, and your Arctic Tempest. What's the current working single word concept for February 2025's Hamlet at the RSC?
Well, there absolutely is one. And if we do what we're currently planning to do, it'll be every bit as one wordy and every bit as vulnerable to mockery and criticism for that. But I'm not going to tell you now. because it's, you'll know when you know.
Sure. Well, you've cast Luke Thallon as your Hamlet. You've worked together in Patriots and Cold War. What about Luke made you feel like he's my Hamlet?
I suppose I'm drawn more to the sensitive feeling poetic Hamlets than the sort of virile revengers. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. I think he has an incredible ability with text to make it sound conversational and yet extraordinary, particularly for a young actor, extraordinary technique to like hit the back row. He's very emotionally available. But it's, you know, I just also think he's really, really good. And, you know, that's the thing with actors is quite early on. The great thing about the classical canon, this is going to sound really pompous, but, you know, you meet an actor and you go, oh, God, this role's waiting for them. You know, I can't wait to see their Hedda Gabler or their Macbeth or whatever it might be. And of course, with parts like Rosalind or Hamlet, who knows, maybe even Jimmy Porter, we're about to do Look Back. You know, you're going to age out of those quite quickly because they're younger people's parts. Mm. And there are these great actors who never got to play them. And you think, oh, I would have loved to have seen so-and-so's, you know, Juliet, whatever it might be. Mm. And so if you find a young actor and you go, oh, that one of those roles is waiting for them, then you want to make that happen. And, you know, even though I meet hundreds and hundreds of actors all the time, it's quite rare I really sort of have that experience. So I'm excited for him.
Yes, as am I. Frequently when people have spoken about working in your productions, they've said how careful you are when it comes to the timing of a note and when you give a note. And evidently that's presumably for, if it's said at the wrong time, too much doubt or too much negative criticism can get in an actor's head and impact their performance. When and where did this care towards the timing of a note come from? And was it based on a mistiming you had maybe in an early production?
Yeah, it's funny at that. I think it's, you know, what do I look for in an emerging director? And I think it's that ability to be sensitive to the actor and really understand that quality, I think is pretty innate. And it's not the same as social sensitivity because it's pure sensitivity to the artist, I think. I had a very, very close friend when I was at university who was, like, I was the director and he was the actor and we were going to go out and do it together. And in fact, I met him actually before I went to university. And so my very first productions as director, he was in, And he sadly died in a car crash when he was really young. So we never quite made that happen. But I guess I kind of always felt comfortable about he was very honest about his own craft, and we talked a lot about acting. So I felt weirdly, I'd spent a lot of time when I was young talking about acting. But I'd go back even earlier at school, you know, the kids who wanted to be actors at school. I was always quite a good listener to. And I think where it came really from is my mother was a children's writer, and she was, you know, published some stuff, sort of like early years picture writing. And she was really successful as a teacher of writing for young people. She sort of discovered Mallory Blackman, for example. Mm-hmm. But she always wanted to write young adult fiction. And she did have a couple of things published, but particularly when I was little, she had a couple of books that I think never quite saw the light of day. And when she was writing for children, I was a child, the oldest child, so I was reader number one. And I think both with actors and writers, somewhere like really young in my upbringing, I kind of... And I see it in my son, who's very sensitive to my wife, who's an actor, you know, that if you're around a creative person when you're a child, it can be quite demanding, because you carry a lot of their emotional vulnerability. Because, you know, any child supports the parent as much as the parent supports the child. And, you know, I did find that demanding. I think when I look back on it, it's worrying that, you know, wanting to make my mum's books as good as they could possibly be.
Yeah.
But also maybe I learned at some level, like, she wasn't going to read me chapter number one and we go like, oh, the plot doesn't work. You know, the timing there was to go, that's wonderful, that's really great. And maybe a few days later to, you know, it's the same thing in a way. But, you know, it's just people reading at some level, I guess. Or not people reading, I think kind of actor reading, creatives reading. And trying to work out what the block is. I'm always amazed, for funny, particularly with writers, actually, they really struggle with directing their own work sometimes, I find anyway, because it's so obvious. And like most people, if they came to a read-through, would go, well, obviously, this person is not doing that right. But it's often catastrophic to say that at that point, even though, people think that you can... It's like quick cooking. Sometimes just something you need to cook the bolognese for 4 hours, not for 1 hour. And and experience helps, but I think you're kind of... You just intuit it.
Yeah. I didn't know that about you. We're surprisingly similar, because my mother is also a children's author and teacher. Yeah. And I was also shy as a child. do you remember a book that you were read as a young child? What's the formative memory of being read to or discovering sort of the earliest story?
My dad used to read as Swallows and Amazons. So rather sort of 50s, sort of Lake Windermere.
Yeah.
He used to read my brother and I that. So I remember that. But I remember as much the act of sort of being in bed with my brother and my dad and him reading, and just the sort of the warmth of that. But I was a voracious reader as a kid. Like, I read a huge amount from really quite a young age. And so most of my reading memories are actually myself rather than being read to, I think.
Sure. It makes sense reading Jonathan Miller at school that you had a good head start to get to that point. You mentioned emerging and young directors a moment ago, and one of my favourite musicals of all time is Company, and you were the assistant director for Sam Mendes' Donmar production in 95. What is your biggest takeaway from that experience, and how has it informed what you look for in your assistant directors?
I was at the Donmar for a year, so Company was just the sort of the final one of that run. Mm. I remember Sam once saying to me, the worst assistants make the best directors. I was a good assistant. I don't think that's true. I really don't think that's true. But I think... I like to have vocal assistants. I like people who tell me they think my work's rubbish. You know, mm-hmm. But I like the pushback. I like opinionated people. I like independent thinking. But, you know, they've got to have good ideas as well. I guess when you're an artistic director, of course, there's, you know, if you're a young director and you want to be an assistant, then working for an artistic director is appealing, I guess, because they're the gatekeepers at some level. I've had loads of great assistants, and you know, it's what do I look for? Yeah, so I look for, and also that they can forge relationships with the actors, and loyalty, that they will be. I say always to my assistants, you can be as critical as like, and I want you to be as brutal as you like to my face, but you can't be slagging the production off to the actors in the bar. And then be generous watchers, which I learnt because I probably was a bit, I would watch and be a director of the room, and I would say, no, you've got to be the fan in the room. You know, you're the one person, actors are incredibly sensitive to the assistant. And as an assistant, you feel like I'm probably a bit invisible or you're functionless, but actually you're almost the most manifest person in the room because you're probably talk less. And so I always say, like, if it's not funny, laugh anyway. Always be at the front of your chair, always be engaged, because you need to give the room that energy. And then afterwards you can say it's boring or they're terrible, but in the room you have to be positive.
In your 1990 Greenwich Theatre Romeo and Juliet, you moved the... we're going through the whole career. Yeah. We're jumping about all over town. You repositioned the interval from where it's normally placed after Mercutio's death to a few scenes later, the Capulet sanctioning Paris's marriage. And I was at an early preview of Cold War in December. We met there, and you said this was the first night we're trying the interval in a different position. How does an interval placement affect a play, and when do you know when you've got it right?
I think you can say something about the kind of way you want the audience to watch the second half. I think, yeah, so with Romeo and Juliet, of course, famously, you know, it is a play of two halves, and everyone says after Mercutio dies, it becomes a sort of dark tragedy, and before that, it's been a kind of ribald comedy. And I was trying to mitigate some of that binary, act two is really different to act one, by pushing the story further. Cold War was a similar thing. It was sort of, the obvious interval point was geographical. We'd moved from Poland to the West. But again, it made the play feel two very disparate things. And so it can kind of be a binding agent if you use it properly. You know, I think you have these, you know, there are certain rhythmic points in any production, you know, the opening 3 minutes, the build to the interval, the sort of accelerator midway through act two. It depends whether you're doing a two-act or a three-act or a four-act structure. But I think hardwired into those structural sensibilities are points when you can hit the accelerator or the brake in interesting ways. And so the interval can ramp you up if you feel you need a bit of a ramp there. And then the post-interval can often kind of allow you to parachute in an interesting way for a bit longer than you would be able to if you put the same scene in the middle of the play. And just there's a freshness, isn't there? There's a sort of an engagement, you know, if you're taking an interval, you know, if you've been desperate for the loo or a drink or something, you're sated at some level and come back. But then there's also the sort of slightly ice creamy effect of the scraping of the tubs and people not really concentrating. So you have to be judicious, but... yeah, I mean, the bigger question is rhythm. It's like, as you sense the rhythm of the evening, whether you might want to go, this would be much better without an interval. The Hunt, for example, I just did it in New York, which we did in London with an interval. We took the interval out, and it was a much stronger, more potent evening. So it's just one of the tools in the box to kind of experiment with.
Completely. When you are watching a preview, what are you, when you're sitting in the dark in the audience, what are you watching for? Is it the play? Is it audience reactions? And are you eavesdropping at the bar during the interval to sort of pick up some early feedback?
Yes, it's quality of listening, quality of watching. Again, I think Sam said that like one of the reasons he thought that theatre directors could be good as screen directors is, although we might lack some of the technical expertise, the hours and hours and hours we spent among audiences is a really helpful thing to, you know, take forward in terms of pacing and storytelling. So, yeah, you're watching for grip. You know, are the audience held or not? You know, are they coughing? That means they're not focused. But then they're also, you know, you're constantly making changes. And it's... I'm always fascinated in theatre that, like, sometimes it's the big, bold change that makes the transformative thing, and sometimes it's a tiny thing. And and also the previews have their own rhythm, and there's the excitement of the first preview. Then everyone says the second night isn't as good, and it is less energised, but often it's much clearer. And then you maybe build to a third, and that's stronger. Then you have a dip for a few shows, and then you pick up again. And, you know, so you're toggling your experiences of that as well as the work you're doing in the day.
Yeah. On Patriots, which I loved as a stand-up piece, I saw in Almeida, and then as a birthday treat, the West End transfer. One particular instance that stood out to me, when you have Boris Berezovsky doing the press conference in London, he pulls down a mask of pictures of Putin's face for Boris and Litvinenko and the security guards. And Will Keane is doing a phenomenal portrayal as Putin, but the faces of the real Putin.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a conscious choice? And if so, why did you make it?
It's partly was referencing
the real event,
obviously. We did talk about it being Will, but I thought it was a potent moment to sort of reintegrate the real Putin, or the idea that these are real characters in a way that was... It's funny, I mean, it's really interesting you picked up on it, because I always thought people might be going, that doesn't make any sense, you know, that there's no consistency. But I think with that, it was the interesting doubleness of the actor, is that the audience were constantly aware that Will was playing Putin and doing the crazy gangster walk and all those things, and taking delight in that. But also, there was a real character elsewhere. And it's why, I think this whole AI thing, AI capture, is less of a threat to our craft than we think. Because I think the best acting always holds that doubleness. Mm. You know, of course you're not really a prince, and we're not really in Denmark, but you're making us believe, and we take extra delight in you doing that. And I think, when I Dear England... Joe Fiennes playing Gareth Southgate, he's quite, in some ways, quite odd casting, and yet part of the thrill was going, God, Joe Fiennes is so like Gareth Southgate, and yet equally, he's completely not Southgate. And so, you know, I think if we'd in the video sections projected the real Southgate, I think that would have been fine. I think audiences are very sophisticated in their ability to toggle those things.
Yeah, and that it's both got a realism, but also the awareness that you're watching art, and therefore great art,
exactly.
If you're able
representation,
to
representation.
Yeah, when you're transferring a show like that, from the UK to US, when you have one actor, sometimes the lead, who doesn't continue with the production. So in Patriots, Tom Holland playing it in London and then replaced by Michael Stuhlbarg in the US, and similarly with Tammy Faye. What is it like then to direct a production in a new location where 99% of the cast are the same, but one person has effectively sort of joined the term halfway through? Does it affect your approach to the restaging?
I think all actors are different, so there's not really one rule about that. Michael Stuhlbarg was completely different to Tom Hollander, and in every way, as artists, as in performance, his relationship to his audience, the American audience. So, you know, you try to keep as open a mind as possible and know that, you know, the things you learned from before, you know, are there usefully to help if the actor is lost or doesn't know what to do, but basically you're going to start again. Mm. It can be tricky when you're doing like quite a quick move, you know, if you've done it and then you recast and someone new comes in.
Yeah.
I think if there's a bit of time between, it can be really interesting. And like Albion, for example, we did twice, and I think coming back about a year or so later to it, I couldn't entirely remember what we'd done the time before. And when I was able to compare the new actors who came in to the ones before, I thought, God, they're just so different. They're bringing something so different. But also the politics of the play had moved on and the context had moved on. And that was true of Patriots as well. Like what the story of Putin meant in America, two superpowers, versus what it meant here, the city of oligarchs, was just a different story. And you move a play... That, you know, whether it's changing the actors or changing the space you're in or changing the time period, when you've performed it, there's so many ways it can evolve, and you just have to stay alert to them if you can.
Yeah. In your filmed work, what struck me is seemingly how much attention you pay to the very opening shot of a film. So in Judy, you have this incredible long take where you have the voices of the studio appearing from the darkness, and then we follow her through and we reveal Oz, seemingly mirroring that moment in Wizard of Oz. In True Story, you've got the slow motion shot of the teddy hitting the luggage. In Richard II, for the BBC, you had a tilt down from the ceiling to the king. For me, that seemed like, this is mirroring the sense of divine right you've been ordained. It seems that you approach an opening shot of a movie the same way a novelist approaches the first line of a text. Is that true, and do you think of it in those terms?
I think more widely I'm interested in openings. I mean, I think my plays as well, I always, you know... I think, you know, you have that moment when it begins, and particularly in theatre, that amazing thing you can have in a play that you enjoy. You can be 5 minutes in and go, oh my God, I'm so gripped, I'm compelled by these characters. And then another show you can see in 5 minutes and you go, this is going to be a really long evening, I'm going to get bored.
Sure.
So you have an opportunity at the beginning to sort of lay your stall out a bit and to grab the audience by the throat in some level and say, you know, this is going to be different. So I am interested in openings and sort of how they declare. I think it's funny, those shots in Judy and Richard II. Oddly, True Story is probably the least successful piece, but actually that opening shot I think is more interesting than, because there's a sort of self-consciousness about the one take, the single take, that is a bit, you know, would be auteurish. And like in Judy, there are two long takes that I think are, you know, you could draw, look on the opening. And I think I was trying to get a bit of, like, the Wizard of Oz thing there. But then the other long single take is Renee's first performance on stage.
The Talk of the Town.
At Talk of the Town, yeah. And I always knew that had to be a single take because I'd seen from other sung performances that the cut always makes you aware that the actor has cheated at someone. You know, you cut to another take.
Yeah.
And we're actually really doing opera and musicals and seeing the sort of, when you're seeing an actor sort of climb an aria, it has a sort of real-time thrill. And so I think that no one really picked up on the single take for the first performance, whereas I think people are more aware of the single take at the top of the film. And I would say it shows that the single take in the performance is a better piece of filmmaking because it works, I think, and partly because the technique does underpin the emotional effect, but the emotional effect is strong enough that you're not thinking about the technique. Whereas I think in the opening, you go, that's a kind of cool shot. We're on, you know, tight on her eyes, and then we end up at the end of the elaborate road.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're kind of... you know, I love sophisticated cinematography, and, you know, I'm still in the foothills of really learning about it. But, you know, I haven't made a screen thing since Judy, and I'm really hungry to go back to that, because, you know, it's the tough thing. And theatre, you can kind of learn on the job a bit and be doing fringe theatre or drama school stuff or regional studio, and no one really sees your mistakes. And whereas on screen, it's too expensive. They see your mistakes from day one, and so you have to learn on the job in a more public eye. And I think I'm only just now more confident enough visually to kind of go, oh, that's what I want to be as a filmmaker.
Presumably that's why you go for less rehearsal time in film than the theatre. You've said before that it's to capture as much as possible, to harvest as much as possible, as opposed to in theatre sort of building the stamina and the framework for 100, 200, 1,000 performances.
Yeah, I mean, rehearsal is sort of interesting just to kind of give some structure for the performances and maybe to talk with the DOP about how you might theoretically block things out. But in my experience, it's a bit like storyboarding. I really struggle with storyboarding and rehearsal on screen. I think it's about locations, being in the location with the DOP, you know, on the recces and really working out what your coverage is going to be before you shoot. Of course, you might change it on the day. And then it's about the thing I love about directing on screen, it's about maximising the time between the first take and the setup completion, and going like, okay, how do we make subtle tweaks, whether it's lighting, camera moves, or in performance, and to keep the concentration on set. And I think, it, weirdly, sometimes if you're over-prepared or dogmatic, you lose an alertness to going, oh, you know, the sun's moved over here now, I think we just, or the frame is slightly more interesting, a bit lower, or just live riffing with the actor and trying to pull something out in the moment that is not repeatable. That's the sort of gold stuff.
Completely. I'm conscious of our time. So the final two questions. One is, when directing René to the Oscar, possibly the best encapsulation of how good you can direct a performance is winning. How do you approach the initial rehearsal and character building and a sort of establishment of the character? I understand that involved a lot of furniture pushing and throwing chairs and pianos.
I think it's funny with great acting. I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with some amazing actor, or amazing performances, I should say. And there are those performances that you sort of, whether it's on stage or screen, you go, this is so transcendent, I just want to make sure I'm giving the best possible frame for it. And so an example of that would be Ben Whishaw, I think, in The Rich the Second we did, you know, pretty much in the first reading, or reading in rehearsals, I was like, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
It's how I, with the greatest amount of love and adoration, literally in that sense, frame it, develop it. And of course there were acting notes and all the normal things you do in a play, but, you know, Ben's genius was just on offer from the beginning. I think with René, that's a different kind of thing where you're much more involved, because I think René was really intimidated about playing Judy Garland. Mm. And also her initial ideas, which most actors have, were outwards rather than inwards. You know, it's like, how can I get the teeth right? What's the contact lenses? How can I get my singing voice right? And my job, I felt, was always to be, yeah, but actually I want René Zellweger. I don't want Judy Garland, because I think there are lots of things in René that you are never getting yourself that are going to be brilliant in the performance. And that was about building up a trust with her, mm-hmm. that I could be quite honest and say, A, you don't need this, but also I want more of that. And she, René, was one of those actors who was incredibly hungry for input. And you know, after every take, you know, would come to me and, you know, want more. And, you know, we would improvise in the scenes even while we were shooting. And it felt much more like a sort of conversation at every step of the way. And so even though it's entirely her performance and her genius, I felt more actively involved in sort of building that one. And then there were moments that René did that, which, yeah, it's the gift of a movie star, where you just put the camera on and you go, oh, wow, you just brought something that I just... And then you do sit and you breathe with the actor, and you just, you know, literally, then when you call cut is a big part of it. The tiniest prompts you might be giving. So they're all kind of different dances in a way. But I think, really, if I was to be super reductive about the director's role with actors and writers, and indeed probably all artists, but particularly director, actors and writers, it is to gently lead them back to themselves, mm. and to find what is personal in the work. Because the writer will bring all their research, and normally the actor will as well. And I always feel my job is to go, yeah, but where are you in it?
Yeah.
And some writers and actors are very comfortable about that and will say, yeah, you're quite right, this is all about my mum or whatever. And others are much more uneasy about sharing that. Mm-hmm. And you know, for example, you know, Ben is very much an out gay man. Rich the Second can often and is often played as a gay character.
Yeah.
We did talk about it, absolutely, but not at any great length. And Ben was not interested particularly in that reading. And yeah, I think if you watch the film, you would totally read it that way. And so that was a case of going, okay, so this is going to be in the tonality of the performance, but we're not really going to front and centre it.
Yeah.
And I had this sort of Terrence Malick sort of mysticism I was interested in, and kind of, you know, even though I'm agnostic, I'm very influenced in art sort of by Catholicism, and I was sort of had a lot of that in it. I probably didn't talk massively to Ben about that, mm-hmm. but, you know, they come together. And so you find your jazz with an actor, and, you know, sometimes, and it's also the role you play, sometimes you have to be very remote from an actor, and you can feel them very frustrated, and they go, they want more feedback, and they want more recognition, they want more involvement. And you know, as a director, that's actually not going to be helpful. That in some ways, them trying to work you out is what's going to release their performance. So it's back to that. Yeah, it's just the dance of working with actors.
Totally. It's back to when to give a note and how to give a note. Yeah. The final question, one I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, is why do we need stories?
I think, you know, there's a sort of glib existential argument that, you know, life is incredibly random and complicated, and we need narrative to give it structure. So I think we as humans are, you know, you see someone on a bus, they're whispering to is it their friend? Is it their lover? Immediately you're constructing a story. We read images as narrative. And so literally we understand the world through narrative. But as socially, why we need stories, I think, is, I think in theatre terms, I think it's very important that we do come together and are able to leave a room together and all be discussing stuff. And, you know, when you say, do I listen to the audience at previews? I think audiences listen to each other. I think they like knowing, oh, so-and-so seemed to love that. On screen, I think it gives, a sort of dignity to human suffering. and that's always worth cherishing.
Sure, a lovely cheery note. Sure. Rupert, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Not at all. Thanks a lot.